Time it took you to buy your ticket. 3.2 minutes. Time it took you to get your popcorn. 2.5 minutes. Time it took them.
Well, let's go.
To steal your car.
Hello, ladies.
60 seconds.
Move, go.
Come on, Swift, baby, work your magic. Hold on, I know you're gonna do what I think you're gonna do.
To go old school.
A day to shop, a day to prep.
Surprise attack.
Nice.
Little trick I learned at the car thief retirement home.
By the time the first car's reported stolen,
all this,
your ship set sail. We do this, we do it my way.
I was a sucker for a redhead.
Friend. Okay, let's ride.
Gone in 60 seconds.
What do you think is more exciting, having sex or stealing cars?
Having sex. Boosting cars.
That's a good line.
Hello and welcome to The Complete Works, an in-depth look into the career and filmography of Nicolas Cage. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me on this journey into the depths of true cagedom is my friend, co-host, and fellow cageaholic,
Mike DiCrescio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good. I think today should be an interesting episode.
We have talked at length about how much we love Nicolas Cage in action blockbusters.
Right.
And now that theory is put to the test. We entered the year 2000 with Nick Cage back in action blockbuster mode. And what better way to get back into that groove, Mike, than re-teaming with producer extraordinaire Jerry Bruckheimer?
Oh, I mean, there's probably better ways.
Well, yeah, Bruckheimer, we covered him on the podcast before. He's well known for producing a lot of the biggest blockbuster movies of the 90s and 2000s, including a lot of Michael Bay's movies and the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise. And, of course, The Rock and Con Air were both Bruckheimer productions. So those are big Cage movies that we talked
right.
about and talked about loving. So you could say they had seen success together before. But would they succeed on their third outing, Mike?
Stay tuned to find out.
That third outing, by the way, is called Gone in 60 Seconds. And if we're speaking financially, then yes, the movie was a huge success, Mike.
Was it? I mean, I think I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, it was made on a budget of about $90 million. It made about $237 million worldwide. Or at least it sounds like a success. There was one columnist, Edward Epstein, who wrote that after all of the film's expenses and all that stuff, and the overhead and the marketing and all that, Gone in 60 Seconds actually lost the studio about $90 million.
Perfect.
Yeah, and that's a peek behind the Hollywood curtain, I guess, because there are a ton of costs that go beyond the budget of an actual movie, and movies that sound like successes actually lose money all the time. Hollywood is a weird business.
Yeah, I've definitely read articles about Hollywood accounting and how no movie ever makes a profit.
So it's you got to wonder why they keep making movies, and yet they keep
doing
it.
Yeah, here we are.
But I remember there was a thing where, like, it was a couple years after Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix came out. That movie made almost $800 million, and it still did not make a profit.
Yeah, at least according to the studio, it didn't make a profit.
Yeah, it made way more than its budget, but it also, like, there were so many other additional costs that it didn't make a profit. And it's like, that movie made $800 million. Like, how did that not make a profit?
Yeah.
Of some kind. Maybe Avatar was the only movie that ever made a profit. $2.8 billion might just scratch the surface.
Maybe. Just maybe.
Anyway, Gone in 60 Seconds would also not be as successful critically as Nicolas Cage and Jerry Bruckheimer's last two collaborations. While The Rock and Con Air each got their share of negative reviews, overall critical consensus was mostly positive for those two movies. Gone in 60 Seconds was decidedly not, and currently sits at a 24% on Rotten Tomatoes. So
wow.
Not great, Mike. Not great.
Not so good.
Not so good. But what is Gone in 60 Seconds, you ask? Mike, you asked.
What is Gone in 60 Seconds?
I'll let you know. It is a remake of a movie from 1974, which is also called Gone in 60 Seconds. And that movie was a low-budget independent film made for about $150,000 and was written, directed by, produced by, and starred in the lead role, H.B. Halicki. Now, Halicki was a stuntman who wanted to use the medium of film to tell his own stories and use it to show off some cool stunts along the way. I actually watched the original Gone in 60 Seconds, Mike, recently, because I am a professional.
Sure.
We'll go with that. We'll say I'm a professional and not I had some time to kill before Saturday Night Live started or something.
Yeah.
Which is the more accurate term. But, you know, I noticed that it was streaming on Amazon Prime, and I knew we were doing this episode in a week or two as the time was a few weeks ago. And so I was like, well, let's might as well give it a whirl. And I got to say, you know, the first hour or so is pretty bad. I will say that the original movie, I don't think the first hour is any good at all, but the final 40 minutes of the film are one long car chase, and it becomes a lot more exciting, and it's a really, really great car chase. And it's a literally 40-minute long car chase. It's the entire climax of the movie. A total of 93 cars are destroyed during this car chase.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it is bonkers. That is an average of more than 2 cars a minute. H.B. Halicki made a few movies after that. A couple of the bigger ones included movies called The Junkman and Deadline Auto Theft, but Gone in 60 Seconds was his baby. And in 1989, he set to work on a sequel in which he and his wife, Denise Shakarian, would star. He gathered 400 cars, which would get destroyed over the course of this movie. And the movie started to film in Buffalo, New York. It's pretty close by. Pretty yeah. Neat. And then, as H.B. Halicki was preparing for the biggest stunt in the film, in which a water tower was supposed to fall to the ground, a cable attached to the water tower snapped, and that cable hit a nearby telephone pole, which fell right on Halicki, killing him instantly.
Wow.
Which is nuts. So that's a crazy story.
Yeah, that's some Final Destination shit.
That is exactly some Final Destination shit. So since Gone in 60 Seconds 2 would remain an unfinished film, H.B. Halicki's wife Denise approached Jerry Bruckheimer in 1995 about producing a remake to preserve her husband's legacy, and thus, Gone in 60 Seconds for the Michael Bay era was born. I did truly feel watching this movie that Jerry Bruckheimer wanted Michael Bay to do this, and he wasn't available.
Oh, 100%. Absolutely.
Like everything is lit in that like slick Michael Bay style. The editing style during the action scenes is so fast that it is often incomprehensible. You can't really tell what's going on a lot of the time. And there's also a weird kind of racist, kind of sexist, not sure which running gag about an Asian female driver.
Oh, yep. So that's both. That's definitely both.
Yep. So straight out of the Michael Bay playbook. It is a Michael Bay movie without Michael Bay. And, you know, you think you don't like Michael Bay movies when Michael Bay is directing them? Imagine when he's not. The man who did direct this movie was Dominic Sena, who spent the early years of his career directing music videos before releasing his feature debut, 1993's California, which starred Brad Pitt, Juliette Lewis, and David Duchovny before any of those people were famous. So that's kind of cool. And California got good reviews, but it didn't make any money, and Dominic Sena didn't direct another film until Bruckheimer recruited him for Gone in 60 Seconds. Since then, he's recruited thrillers like Swordfish and Whiteout, and most recently, he reunited with Nicolas Cage for 2011's Season of the Witch, which one day we will talk about in the distant future, in the not too distant future, way down in Deep 13. I assume we'll be Mystery Science Theater riffing that movie, which is why I'm making that reference.
We'll just be living in the Hunger Games apocalypse by then.
That's true. So we will be in Deep 13. Does the Hunger Games does the Mystery Science Theater take place in the Hunger Games universe?
Maybe. We at least knew the third Hunger Games took place in Deep 13, in District 13.
So it could be. I mean...
New headcanon confirmed.
Man, I would pay money to watch Katniss and Peter riffing on, like, Manos the Hands of Fate or something. I think that would be great.
That would be awesome.
And Woody Harrelson's got to be there too, also. Anyway, Gone in 60 Seconds was written by Scott Rosenberg, at least at first. Rosenberg also wrote Con Air, which is presumably why Jerry Bruckheimer hired him. But after some disagreements with Dominic Sena about rewrites, Scott Rosenberg left the project. He is still the credited writer on the movie, but a couple of uncredited writers came in to punch up the script. One of them was Jonathan Hansley, the writer of films like Die Hard with a Vengeance and the 2007 Nicolas Cage movie Next. He's also the director of 2004's The Punisher. And the other uncredited writer, Mike, was none other than J.J. freaking Abrams.
What?
right? Director of all of the things you've ever felt nostalgia for.
Yeah.
Plus, Nicolas Cage did most of his own stunts in this movie, too, and ended up liking it so much that he's pursued race car driving as a hobby since the film's release, which is kind of neat.
That's kind of awesome.
That's kind of cool. And there were 7 replicas of the main car in this movie. The main car is called Eleanor. During this movie's production, 5 of them were totaled during stunts that were shot for this movie. One of them went to Jerry Bruckheimer, who still has the car, but never takes it out because he's afraid of like scratching it or damaging it in any way. The other one went to Nicolas Cage, who still takes it out for joyrides occasionally. So that's,
there you go.
That's neat, too. Maybe he does that while he's race car driving.
Yeah.
And like the other Nicolas Cage, Jerry Bruckheimer joints, Gone in 60 Seconds boasts a phenomenal cast. You know, we talked about that in The Rock and Con Air. Like, the cast for those movies is insane. And this movie is no different. A lot of the roles are filled out by people who would become much more famous later on. But Nicolas Cage stars in the lead role as Randall Memphis Reigns, while Angelina Jolie appears as the de facto female lead as Sarah Sway Wayland. Giovanni Ribisi stars as Cage's brother Kip Reigns, doing his creepy Giovanni Ribisi thing.
Yeah.
And Robert Duvall is in this movie as Otto Halliwell. So that quartet of people right there is pretty insane already. Like, that's a pretty great cast right there.
Yeah.
And then you've got Delroy Lindo as Detective Roland Castlebeck, who is pretty well known for his roles in a couple of different Spike Lee movies, including Malcolm X. Timothy Oliphant, later of Deadwood and of Justified fame, is his partner, Detective Drykoff. So this is before he was, you know, Timothy Oliphant, and he was just a guy. He was just like the smooth-talking detective who's like the second banana to the main detective. Will Patton from the TV series Falling Skies plays Atlee Jackson, while Chi McBride from Pushing Daisies and the remake of Hawaii Five-0 plays Donnie Ostricki. Vinnie Jones is in this movie. He's the best character in this movie. The Sphinx. He might be the best character because he doesn't have to actually speak. But
doesn't have to do anything. That's great.
But of course, Vinnie Jones was in a couple of Guy Ritchie movies like Snatch and Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. He's also the Juggernaut in X-Men 3. He's awesome. And fucking Christopher Eccleston is in this movie. Not enough of it, I should add. As the film's villain, Raymond the Carpenter Calitri. And he is, of course, crushing it on The Leftovers. He's amazing on that show. And he was at one point Doctor Who. Which doesn't mean anything to me, but to other people, it does.
Yeah, big deal.
Yeah. And that's not to mention some other appearances, like Scott Kahn, who's also on Hawaii Five-0, weirdly enough. And he's also James Kahn's son.
that was just a weird tidbit to throw in.
Well, he is. That's
I mean, he is. You're right.
Yeah. Frances Fisher, who was Kate Winslet's mother in Titanic, is in this movie. Grace Zabriskie, as Cage and Ribisi's mother, is in this movie. She was, of course, in Twin Peaks as Laura Palmer's mother. Also, she was in Wild at Heart, which makes this a Nicolas Cage reunion.
There you go.
Got that David Lynch connection going on.
Yeah.
Master P is in this, letting you know that this is indeed the year 2000.
Yeah, we've entered the millennium.
This is the P-ennium.
That
does not sound good at all.
That didn't work.
But he's in this in a pretty small role. And then Michael Pena appears in this movie before he was Michael Pena as Ignacio, who is basically there just to make a poop joke. Also, character actor John Carroll Lynch appears uncredited as an impound manager. He was the Zodiac Killer in Zodiac, or the likely Zodiac Killer. And he was also in Face Off, making for another Nicolas Cage reunion. So that's pretty neat. Two reunions for the person.
We're getting to the point where Cage has been in every movie ever, so the reunions are going to start stacking up, I think.
I think so, too. Yeah, that's already been happening for a while. Like, at a certain point, every movie we've done has had like at least one. Pretty neat.
Which is fun. That's exciting.
Yeah, it's a cool little tidbit of information that we are doling out to you, the audience. And of course, the movie stars Eleanor, the car from the original movie, which makes a reappearance here. In the original movie, Eleanor is actually credited as an actor in the film. The movie starts off and it says starring Eleanor, and I was watching it and I was like, who's Eleanor? I don't know an actor with the only, like, that was just by the name Eleanor with no last name. But the car is Eleanor. And to this day, it is the only film. The original movie is the only film that lists a car as an actor.
I mean, that's if there's ever a fun fact, that's the one.
That's a fun fact right there. So Gone in 60 Seconds was written by Scott Rosenberg and directed by Dominic Sena. The IMDb plot synopsis reads, a retired master car thief must come back to the industry and steal 50 cars with his crew in one night to save his brother's life. That is a good plot synopsis, IMDb. I'll give them props for that.
That is. Good job.
Yeah, solid stuff. So, Mike, what are your overall thoughts on Gone in 60 Seconds?
I think that your description of a Michael Bay movie without Michael Bay... perfectly sums up all of my feels about this movie.
Yeah. It's a Michael Bay movie without a lot of the cool stuff that Michael Bay is capable of doing, you know?
Yeah, there's an orange or blue filter on every shot.
Absolutely.
for a heist movie, because that's what this movie is at its core. It's a car heist movie.
Yeah, theoretically.
Theoretically, right? Like, nothing really happens for a good, what is this, an hour and a half movie? And
2 hours.
It's 2 hours, yeah. And it feels like it's 90 minutes, probably more. Nothing is going on other than successfully stealing cars. Like, and as interesting as that is, it's just a montage of them opening car doors and driving away. And like, kind of, that's it.
Yeah, I was not really a fan of this movie. I had expected going in that I wasn't going to like this that much. There is some decent fun to be had in parts. There are like fun individual scenes, but it's overall a very weak narrative experience with not enough action to make up for it. You know?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
I can forgive action movies a lot. You know, I love action movies, and like,
we both loved Con Air.
Yeah, we're both big fans of Con Air. We love The Rock. We love Face Off, and you know, those movies have a lot more story going on, I would say. But, you know, those movies also have a lot more action going on, too. So even if there wasn't much story there, you can still enjoy it on the basis of, like, oh, shit, look at this happening. Look at this happening. This movie really doesn't have much going on in the action department for a long time. And even then, even when it does have action, it is edited to within an inch of its life. You can barely tell what's going on in a lot of these scenes.
Like you said, it's Michael Bay without Michael Bay, so like it's not even interesting or possibly exciting, because it's just, we're gonna see a close-up of a foot stomping on a pedal, and then a close-up of someone's face, and then we don't know where they're going, and that's it. That's a car chase.
I wasn't really a big fan of the original movie either, as I mentioned before, but at least that had a really great inventive and creative car chase that I could actually see. This movie's car chase is A, shorter, B, it's not the climax of the movie, C, not as exciting as the car chase in The Rock.
I forgot about that.
D, is so haphazardly edited that it was difficult to follow. And E, it was almost definitely reusing footage throughout the car chase. There was definitely at least twice I saw Delroy Lindo use, like, say, oh shit, in the exact same cadence and making the exact same body movements. And it was like that happened. That definitely happened twice in the movie. I was not going crazy.
That happened.
You know, there is some creative and cool stuff happening in this movie, but you know, all of that stuff just gets in the way, and it gets in its own way a lot of the time. And you know, this movie came out in 2000. A year later, Ocean's 11 and The Fast and the Furious would both be released, and they would do what this movie tries to do, but so much better.
Yeah,
it's actually not even a contest. It's actually insane. And this is a fun ensemble. You know, there's a lot of good people in this movie, but it is way too big. I think there's too many people in this movie. There's like a mix of like big stars and like other people who aren't big stars. Virtually everyone is given almost nothing to do in this movie, especially Angelina Jolie, who, despite getting second billing in the credits, there's no way she's in more than 10 minutes of this movie total.
No.
They wait until an hour and 20 minutes into the movie to decide, hey, we should give her some lines. Like, we should maybe try to develop this character a little bit. Even then, they don't really. It's all, like, it's rough. But what did you think of Nicolas Cage in this movie, Mike?
I think this is an interesting development for him in some weird way, because for the most part, he gets to the Cage we know and love. But for the majority of this runtime, he's deadpan serious. I got out and they keep pulling me back in character.
Right.
And it's kind of interesting. I kind of like that in some weird way. I thought it's his deadpan sarcasm is pretty funny when he gets the chance to do it. There's the scene when he walks out of the diner after talking with his mom, and the two detectives confront him. And the detective is giving him the runaround. He's talking about he's telling him the story of a phone call he had, and he keeps being like, well, then he said, and then I said, and then he said, and Cage just delivers the perfect, wow, you guys said a lot. So Cage is given the opportunity in the beginning of towards the beginning of the movie to be the deadpan guy or the serious dude. And then after he steals Eleanor towards the end of the film and things happen, he starts doing the weird, crazy screaming, delivering lines. Like he's talking, he tries to argue that Eleanor, even though she's a little beat up at the end, he still fulfills the contract or whatever. Right. And he's like, you take 80 from 200 and we have a deal. And he starts screaming it like that. Yeah, and he says it a couple emphasis. Times in a row.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What were you gonna say?
That was I was just okay. gonna say. I think it's weird how he starts off straight and then falls back into this weird cage thing that he does all the time at the end of the film.
Yeah, maybe that's a deliberate choice because his character starts off straight and then falls back into his old patterns. So maybe I'm giving this movie too much credit, but that is...
Yeah, it's the meta narrative, Mike. Good job.
But yeah, I thought Cage was solid. The role doesn't really allow him to cage out all that much, you know. Like The Rock and Con Air and Face Off, they all work partially because they let Cage get a little nuts. You know, like there is some insane Cage stuff going on in those movies. His performance here kind of reminded me of Firebirds, where he's mostly supposed to play pretty determined, and yet he does add those little touches kind of throughout the movie that I love. I think the best scene of the movie is the scene in which he's pretending to be a man named Roger. When he's like at the car dealership.
I forgot about that.
It is delightful.
My name's Roger, sir. May I be of some help?
That's funny. My name's Roger. Two Rogers don't make a right. Roger, I have a problem.
Yes.
I've been in LA for 3 months now. I have money, I have taste. But I'm not on anybody's A-list, and Saturday night is the loneliest night of the week for me.
Well, a Ferrari would certainly change that.
Perhaps. But you know, this is the one, yes. Yes, yes, I saw three of these parked outside the local Starbucks this morning, which tells me only one thing. There's too many self-indulgent wieners in this city with too much bloody money. Now, if I was driving a 1967 275 GTB 4 cam...
You would not be a self-indulgent wiener, sir. You would be a connoisseur.
Precisely. Champagne would fall from the heavens, doors would open, velvet ropes would part.
I don't have one here. However, I do have one in the warehouse.
Superb. What else do you have in the warehouse?
There's good stuff. And he has this like weird habit of quickly shouting a bad joke and then laughing at it really fast. And he does this a couple times in the movie. During that Roger scene, the salesman comes up to him and he's like, "Oh, hi, my name's Roger." And Cage is like, "Oh, what a coincidence. My name's Roger, too. But two Rogers don't make it right. Ha, 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 ha." It was the best scene in the movie. And there's the scene where he's recruiting Angelina Jolie onto the team, and she says something like, "Hey, you look like a Bible salesman," and he goes, "You're healed!" Yeah. like really fast, and it's like, and then he laughs at it again, and it's just a weird character tick that only comes up a couple of times. But I enjoyed that aspect of his character anyway. How do you think this role fits into the roles that we've seen Cage play so far, Mike?
I think it's an interesting thing. Like, we talked about, you know, he wins the Oscar. It's the thing we always come back to, that he applauds the effort of small indie films, and we need these kind of things. And then he goes off and makes the We Made It Mod trilogy.
Yeah.
And then we get Bringing Out the Dead, which is kind of a throwback to like the Leaving Las Vegas type movie. And then we're back with Gone in 60 Seconds.
Yeah, I think at this point in his career, he's kind of alternating between the weird, like the weirder movies and the blockbuster movies. Like, they're kind of like alternating back and forth.
Yeah, but I feel like this Gone in 60 Seconds doesn't add anything new. I don't know. It feels kind of just. I feel like we're getting into rote Nick Cage territory already, and it's already 2000, and it's only 2000.
I mean, there is still a lot of good stuff to come.
There is still a lot of really good stuff.
But this is his first bad blockbuster, if you don't count Firebirds, I guess.
Right. Which I don't know if you would.
I mean, Firebirds was intended to be a blockbuster.
It was a try at a blockbuster.
It did not make money, and it wasn't good. But I mean, but yeah, Gone in 60 Seconds. It made money. It did well at the box office. But you know, it got a bad critical response, and I think time has aged this movie poorly. I feel like people still talk about The Rock and Con Air and Face Off. Like, these are still like well regarded movies. And nobody really talks about Gone in 60 Seconds anymore. It's not like at the tip of the cultural consciousness, so to speak. But yeah, this reminded me a little bit of Firebirds, and especially the relationship between Nicolas Cage and Angelina Jolie reminded me a lot of the relationship between Cage and Sean Young in Firebirds, because like that movie, there is nothing to indicate that Cage and Jolie have history together until they mention it very late into the movie. And you're like, wait, what? Like, what are they talking about?
And then they make out on a gear shift. It's really weird.
So, suddenly they have like a romantic past, and it's like, that was never mentioned. You've had several scenes with this person. there's nothing to indicate in the scene where Nicolas Cage recruits Angelina Jolie to the team that they knew each other previously. I'm almost positive of that fact. And so that was very upsetting. And then, of course, there's the Jerry Bruckheimer connection as well. So that kind of reminds me of The Rock and Con Air, too. But were there any moments in this or scenes in this movie that stood out to you, Mike?
Just going back for a second to Cage's playing the straight man for the most of it. It's interesting that Christopher Eccleston's character is Kate. Like, he gets the Cage role in this.
Yeah.
I wanted to point that out for just to bring it up that it's weird that Nicolas Cage's character. I mean, I guess it makes sense, like you said, that Memphis got out once and now he's trying to live the straight life, so he's not in that mode until he's back in it at the end. But like Christopher Eccleston's character is like the Cage villain. He's weird. He's yelling lines. He's telling us about his carpentry, and it's really bizarre.
Yeah, that was pretty weird. And yeah, Eccleston is just he's only in like two or three scenes in this movie, which is a bummer because he's great in it. Like he's as always, Christopher. Like I really grew an appreciation for Christopher Eccleston with The Leftovers because I hadn't watched Doctor Who. I'm not like a Doctor Who guy, but I first kind of caught wind of him in The Leftovers, and then I remember seeing him in The Leftovers and then being blown away that he was so wasted in Thor 2.
Right.
That he was like this like elfish villain who had like 10 lines in the movie and they were all in elfish and he was like covered in makeup. That could have been any actor, but for some
reason. That could have been anyone, yeah.
But for some reason it was Christopher Eccleston. So I'm glad he had more to do in this movie than he did in Thor 2. Because he is only in a couple scenes, but he really makes the most of those scenes that he's in. You know, he has this great line at some point in the movie where this is towards the end, where he's saying it doesn't matter which Rain's brother he kills. And then his line is, "It never rains, but it pours."
Then he slams a phone down.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It is great. And his evil villain character tick is that he builds custom furniture, which, sure.
Why not?
And that does result in a fun scene in the climax where Cage breaks some of the furniture and Eccleston's like, "No, what are you doing? No." And then his death is hilarious too. His death scene is really funny because he's about to kill the cop, Delroy Lindo's character, and then Cage just pretty much drop kicks him over a ledge. he falls through the floor to his death, and he lands in the coffin that he himself built earlier.
It's like some Joker level dumb like Batman puns.
Yeah,
like
it is absurd. It is ridiculous. Yeah. It's like the end of Rogue One where the Death Star kills Ben Mendelsohn's character, which is which is his own creation. It's like, oh man, he's but even then, like he's not killed by the coffin. He just lands in the coffin. So there's not even any kind of like dramatic irony in that sense. It's just like he just lands in the coffin he built.
Yeah.
So that was silly. Yeah, Christopher Eccleston's a lot of fun in this movie. And yeah, Angelina Jolie's character, Sway. I got to talk about a couple of things about this character, because when she's first introduced, she says she wants no part with this job, right? She's got a respectable life now. That was the entire point of her first scene. Now, it's Angelina Jolie, so we know she'll be involved eventually, right, in some capacity. Yeah. But there's no moment where she changes her mind or explains her motivations or anything. She just shows up.
Yeah.
Right? And Cage is like, "Oh, that's Shay." And everybody's like,
"Okay."
She's
just part of the crew then.
And she's just part of the crew. And I'm pretty confident she has maybe two lines up until her like flirty scene with Cage, which is in the car, which is an hour and 15 minutes into the movie. And any character backstory you were trying to push like should have been established by now. And the movie like suddenly and without warning decides to push for a romance between these two characters, which falls completely flat because Jolie doesn't have a character and she has nothing to do in this movie.
Her character is 90% Dreads. Like that's it. That's all she is.
I was a little taken aback when she like first emerged from under the car and she was blonde. I was like, "Oh, whoa, that's weird," because Angelina Jolie is traditionally not blonde and she had dreads, and I was like, that's odd.
That's even weirder.
But yeah, I think Vinnie Jones as Sphinx is my favorite character because his character is mute, so at least he's intentionally not given lines.
It's part of his character.
Yeah, and his intro, which shows he's a mortician who casually places a sandwich on a corpse. That's pretty funny. I enjoyed that. Yeah. I also enjoyed when he blew up Master P's car, even though that would almost certainly have drawn the attention of the police.
Right.
And him speaking at the end in an intellectual, philosophical way got a genuine laugh out of me. I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, here comes the mute character with the Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
I feel that's an easy joke, but it's a joke that landed. I thought that was pretty solid.
Yeah, it still worked.
Yeah. And I also enjoyed the two masterpiece scenes. You know, that's how I have to refer to them, I guess. In the first one, Vinnie Jones blows up his car after Master P tries to get into a fight with Nicolas Cage. And in the second one, Nicolas Cage and Giovanni Ribisi destroy Master P's car with a big rig. Basically, I guess I enjoy watching Master P get his comeuppance.
Like, I guess you're right.
Take that, Master P.
I think my favorite scene along the lines of the silliness is when the detective shows up at the warehouse right after they've accidentally stolen the car full of heroin, and they're like trying to figure out how to clear the heroin that got spilled. And it's just silly, and you know, there's some tension, and it's mostly because Robert Duvall is the main one acting, and he's great.
Yeah, and that heroin scene is actually straight from the original movie too. Most of this movie has almost no resemblance to the original film, except for the fact that it has a car chase towards the end, and there's that heroin scene, and there's also one scene. There's a scene where there's a snake in the car, right?
Yeah.
There's a scene where.
They steal the Hummer.
Yeah, it's Vinnie Jones and the one other guy, TJ, I think his name was.
And Mirrors or something?
Mirror Man, yeah. They're still in the car and there's a snake in there. In the original movie, that's a tiger. And it makes even less sense in the original movie than it does in this one. But anyway, the heroin scene is almost identical to the one from the original movie, and the snake scene is very similar too. But I enjoyed the heroin scene. I thought that was solid. And in the original movie, the heroin scene is completely extraneous. Like, it has no bearing on anything that's happening. In this movie, at least, it involves a detective discovering, like, a thing in their lair, in their hideout, that, like, allows him to figure out what they're doing later. It serves that purpose, at least. And it's a pretty, like, funny, like, solid scene. I enjoyed the snake scene too. I thought that was entertaining, at least. And, you know, they're trying to get away and, like, they're bashing into other cars and stuff while they're doing it. You know, it's fun. Also, DMX's Up In Here is playing throughout that scene, which is a lot of fun. Actually, the whole soundtrack of this movie is great.
Yeah, in case you needed another reminder that it happens in the year 2000.
Exactly. But the whole soundtrack, there's the big lowrider scene.
Which, like, what?
I guess the movie was trying to convey that is the song that Cage plays to psych himself up before a job.
Yeah,
which was interesting. It's an interesting choice of song. You know, it's a little like eccentric character tick for Cage, I guess. And I enjoyed that scene. I enjoyed the song Lowrider, so sure. I also enjoyed other songs in the soundtrack, like the aforementioned Up In Here. I enjoyed the scene where Cage and Duvall are on the phone trying to recruit people, and it's playing "I've Seen Better Days." I've seen better days. And of course, at the very end of the movie, the most on the nose song choice of all time, "Been Caught Stealing" by Jane's Addiction. That is a song choice for this movie that would make the soundtrack supervisor of Suicide Squad cringe.
Yeah.
Okay, it's just so on the nose, but I enjoy that nonetheless. I enjoy really goofy soundtrack ticks, I guess. But yeah, I do. I will say some of the jokes in this movie do land. Like, there's some solid stuff in there. Maybe it's because J.J. Abrams was doing uncredited rewrites. I don't know. But there's one line that made me laugh kind of hard when Giovanni Ribisi's character shows up with his own crew in tow. I think that was part of the problem with the movie, was that, again, there were so many people on that crew that it's hard that's hard to care about all of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not like Ocean's 11 has 11 people on their crew, and that's a lot. But all of them feel like distinctive characters. And in this movie, I can tell you which ones are people that are people I recognize, like that are famous people who I can point to, like, hey, that's Vinnie Jones. Hey, that's Angelina Jolie. Hey, that's Robert Duvall. Giovanni Ribisi's crew is almost entirely, like, extraneous humans. Like,
they're just bodies.
They are just bodies. And there's, like, one, like, Mirror Man was kind of funny. And there was, like, a guy named TJ, or I think he was the kid, right, who got shot or something.
I don't know. Like, a guy gets shot, and, like, I don't even know, like, sure.
I barely remember who that guy was, yeah.
Yeah.
But there's, like, one line when Giovanni Ribisi is introducing his crew to Nicolas Cage's crew, and he's, like, describing all the jobs they can do, and one of them's, like, good with computers, one of them's good with this. It's like, what about that guy? It's like, oh, that's Freb, which is a stupid name. And they're, like, trying to think of Freb, and it's like, oh, Freb, he can order pizzas like nobody's business. You know, that was a funny line, and Freb, like, goes along with it, like, yeah, man, people got to eat. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, there is some fun banter stuff going on between this huge crew, like the pairing of Mirror Man and the guy who never shuts up with the guy who doesn't talk.
Sure,
like that's an easy setup.
Natural pairing, yeah.
Yeah, like, it's fun. It's silly. He keeps saying he's gonna kick his ass, and you know, and then he gets stared down by Vinnie Jones, and he backs off, and it's funny.
Yeah, so it's fun. I also wanted to talk about the scene with Nicolas Cage and Angelina Jolie in the car when they basically reveal that they had a romantic history now that the movie is an hour and a half over. But I want to talk about that scene because I feel like there's such a hugely missed opportunity in that scene. So there's this, like, they open that scene and Angelina Jolie asks him, so what do you think is more exciting, having sex or stealing cars? And Nicolas Cage has to think about it for like a minute, like a long
minute.
A while. He's thinking about it. And then he like looks back at her and says, having sex while stealing cars. Like that.
the smoothest line of all time.
Best pickup line ever. And I that was the first thing I thought of when she said it. And I was like, oh, well, that would be perfect. And he said it. So good job. but yeah, so there's that scene and they start to make out a little bit. And then, you know, she like kind of like she kind of gets out of the mood when he starts talking about the cars and stuff. And then the couple that they're like staking out and like trying to see if they can go in the other room or whatever, that couple is having sex, which is what prompted this conversation. And so I thought it would be really interesting if when they started taking off the car, like started stealing the car and like doing all the things they had to do to steal the car, if they would cut back and forth between them stealing the car and the couple having sex. And like have it being like cross cut to show, because they had that kind of, they already brought up the comparison about stealing cars and having sex. So I thought it would be a really interesting juxtaposition. And you can see them, you can have like a lot of visual fun with that. Like a lot of, there could be a lot of visual jokes about like, I don't know about the mechanics of stealing cars, but if there's like, if there is some kind of motion you have to do stealing a car that resembles the motion you have to do during sex, like that would be.
I mean, we already earlier in the film see Cage walk up to Eleanor and lovingly caress the hood.
Exactly.
And the curve of the roof. Like, they already did it. Like, just do it again.
Yeah, it seems like a huge missed opportunity. That could have been a really fun, funny scene. But anyway, so that I wanted to bring that up because that just seems like a big missed opportunity to me. What did you think of the car chase, the big car chase that this movie is supposed to be built around?
That E.T. did the ending of it better.
Like, when he flew in the air? Is that what you...
Yeah, like the really long jump that happens at the end. Like,
well, that jump is in the original movie too. And the thing is, in the original movie, that's an actual jump. Like they actually did that jump. And I feel like in this movie, you could like the jump is edited together, and like you can tell it's not it's not a jump that is as long as it actually is. If they actually did the jump, so that's a bit of a bummer for sure.
Especially because the length of it becomes just this like clip art car flying over a backup of cars and then landing. I'm sure they did do some type of jump.
Yeah, I'm sure there was definitely stunt work involved. Like I said, Nicolas Cage did most of his own stunts in this movie. I will say there is some fun stuff in the car chase. Like when Cage is driving in reverse. I enjoyed that part of the car chase, and when he like looks out in the other car and smiles at the kid who's like looking at him in the car. He's like, hey.
Yeah, there is some fun things happening when, you know, they're in the alleys and they're avoiding the dump trucks or whatever's going on.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it feels like a pretty rote car chase. There's nothing particularly exciting happening.
Yeah. It's about half the length of the original car chase, and it's not as good, so.
Right, so thank God.
So there's that. But anyway, so are there any other scenes this movie stood out to you, Mike, or should we move on to Netflix reviews?
I think we're good. I think we've kind of described our overall feelings pretty well about how it kind of lacks a lot of stuff.
Yeah, there is like some mildly fun times happening here. I feel like there's the seeds of a good movie here. If it had like a stronger screenplay and stronger direction and overall was just stronger.
Yeah, because like you said too, the you know, comparing it to Ocean's 11, which has I don't know how many members are in the crew in Gone in 60 Seconds, but it's probably near 11.
It's a huge number. Yeah.
Yeah. And it manages to handle that ensemble really well by having the characters be real, by being able to play off each other and be interesting. And Gone in 60 Seconds fails on all those.
Ocean's 11 did all the heist stuff really well, and Fast and Furious did all the car stuff really well. Gone in 60 Seconds fails at both of those things. So.
Right. so watch those other two movies instead.
Yeah, so that's unfortunate. But let's move on to Netflix reviews, Mike, shall we?
Yes.
All right, let's do it. Here are some Netflix reviews for Gone in 60 Seconds. Here's a 5-star review of Gone in 60 Seconds. Love! 2! This movie! 2! Have watched it many times. Great stars, little suspense, good story, cars, and speed and chases. Those two words are in all caps. Also 2! One of my major loves of movies. By the way, if it's any diff, I'm a woman. Cool Nicolas Cage did X amount of stunts. Please to enjoy. One exclamation point.
For those first two sentences, I thought it was Nick Cage writing it.
yeah, no, it was not. Here's a 2-star review of Gone in 60 Seconds, which makes a pretty good reference. Overall, Gone in 60 Seconds 2000 is an okay time waster, but as Tracy Tom says in Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof, you're better off with the real one, not that Angelina Jolie bullshit. And that is a line from Death Proof. That is a big thing right there. That Death Proof reference has Gone in 60 Seconds there. And, of course, Death Proof is probably hugely influenced by the original Gone in 60 Seconds in terms of its car action.
Right. The whole time I was watching Gone in 60 Seconds, I was just wishing I was watching Death Proof. That's for real. That's a real thought I had.
I was going to say, I feel like you think that while you're watching most movies, though, because you really like Death Proof. But
I mean, especially car chase movies.
No, I feel you. Anyway, here's a 4-star review of Gone in 60 Seconds. I like Nicolas Cage. In my opinion, I think he's a good actor, and therefore I like this movie. I'll watch it again if I want to.
Sure, that person's an adult. They can do whatever they want.
I like that, though. It's like, I like Nicolas Cage. In my opinion, I think he's a good actor, and therefore I like this movie. Like, that is the reason he likes this movie, is because Nicolas Cage is a good actor. He says nothing about Nicolas Cage's performance in this movie.
No.
And one day, perhaps if he wants to, he'll watch it again. Here's a 5-star review of Gone in 60 Seconds. Best movie of 2000. Nicolas Cage is amazing. So is Angelina Jolie in this movie. Eleanor is my favorite car, and this movie is BA, which I assume he means badass. I would recommend that if your kid is going to watch it, that he should be interested in cars and like fast-paced, awesome movies. If not, he will not like this movie. He should be at least 12 years old to at least understand this amazing movie. All the other actors have nothing on Nicolas Cage in this movie. They should make it where it is an instant movie. I'm tired of watching the trailer, and I can't find the movie anywhere. And does anybody have any suggestions on where to find this movie? Thanks. P.S. Best movie ever.
I thought I was going to end with "This is a cry for help." Just like slowly help devolves.
They have taken my family. Please watch God in 60 Seconds.
This comment brings up a good point where it says they should love cars. I feel like even on that front, this movie doesn't do justice to, like, cars.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. Like, I'm not a big car guy. Like, I don't.
Yeah, I'm not a gearhead or anything like that. Yeah, but
I feel like you get there are over 50 cars in this movie that you see for maybe like a split second.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of pointless.
It is. So here's a 2-star review of Gone in 60 Seconds. This movie was all right. Nicolas Cage was all right in it. He liked stealing cars a lot. The Russian bad guy in it was cool. Angelina Jolie was all right in it. It's too bad she had to do political movies later in her career. I don't like her as much now. I don't like Brad Pitt either. He's annoying. At least Angelina Jolie wasn't annoying in this. As for later films, most of the other actors don't do a whole lot in this movie. Delroy Lindo was cool as a cop. Other than that, this movie didn't have much going for it. Overall, it could have been a lot better, and it's not that great.
I mean, I can't disagree with that last sentence, at least.
Yeah, I can't I feel like it's tough to disagree with most of that review, although I think it is a weird tangent against Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt. Pretty unnecessary. And finally, here's a 3-star review of Gone in 60 Seconds. I have to start out by saying I can't stand Nick Cage. Raising Arizona, Wild at Heart, and of course, I hated him at Leaving Las Vegas with a passion. They are describing 3 of his best films as some of the worst movies.
As the worst movies, yeah.
After Con Air, I wish he'd leave Hollywood. Even though this movie is completely predictable and most of the scenes are cheesy, the keys get eaten by the dog and the dopes dig them out of the feces while some gangbangers are revolted. Idiotic. I hate to admit, I'm embarrassed to admit I like this movie. The rapport between Jolie was almost unbearable, but even with all its faults, I liked it, especially Delroy Lindo. Yet I still agree with another reviewer. If the bad guy lets your brother go as long as you show up with 50 cars in 3 days, wouldn't it have made more sense to have been gone in 60 seconds out of the country? Oh, well. So, yeah, that is the 3-star review of Gone in 60 Seconds.
I mean, sure.
Make some good points. Make some solid, interesting points that I think we should all take to heart. But anyway, that is that should wrap up our Gone in 60 Seconds review, Mike. So is there any last thoughts you want to leave us on before we wrap up today?
I think this one's a swing and a miss.
I would say so.
I don't remember when the exact timeline of the movies, but we got maybe 10 more years of pretty solid Cage stuff happening.
Sure.
That we have to get through before we get into direct-to-DVD every 4 months Cage.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, there's still some solid blockbusters on the way. We got the National Treasures coming up, right, which I haven't seen in years, but I have fond memories of. So, you know, we'll see what happens there. Hopefully they hold up.
Yeah.
And those are also Jerry Bruckheimer productions, throwing that out there as well.
Look at that.
But anyway, yeah, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons and Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all my podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. And I started writing some stuff for crookedscoreboard.com. You can check that out there. Thank you so much for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike DiCriccio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. You can help support this podcast and Filmbook by taking part in our Patreon campaign. You can find our Patreon campaign page at patreon.com/filmbook. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. You can list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce so many different types, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks for another episode of The Complete Works, in which we'll be talking about Nicolas Cage's role in director Brett Ratner's The Family Man. So I'm interested in that. I was actually listening to the Slash Filmcast a while ago, and David Chen and Jeff Donato did an After Dark, and they ended up talking about The Family Man for like a half hour.
Wow.
So that was interesting, to say the least. So now I have more context to view this movie in. So
we're in good company.
Yeah, exactly. Plus, you can keep an eye out for Film Bookcast, where we will be discussing the directorial debut of Jordan Peele, Get Out. I am very excited about this movie, Mike. I've heard great things about it. Actually, it comes out tomorrow as of this recording, and it still has a 100% of Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, I was going to say, I remember seeing last night that it's still sitting at 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. So, yeah,
so that's very exciting. Yeah. Very stoked for that. And actually, there's a new movie coming out this weekend, too, that I remember you were telling me about. That's premiering on Netflix tomorrow. I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, the directorial debut of Macon Blair.
Yeah. So that's exciting.
Yeah. I just came to mind. But throwing that out there, if anybody wants to watch that, they can.
There you go.
I'm not going to stop you. Anyway, thanks so much for listening, guys. And thanks for getting in the cage.